in America's drug culture.
Learning how to save someone from an opiate overdose.
Every minute counts.
One man is separating fact from fiction.
Dozens of Americans die every day from opioid addiction.
I think there's a lot more families out there that deal with this than anybody could ever imagine.
This is Drugs in America with Curtis Sliwa.
This past Saturday, May 5th, 2018, I felt like I was in an episode of The Twilight Zone with Rod Serling as the host. How ironic. He used to smoke L&M cigarettes right on air, right on TV, and eventually died of lung cancer. But this time machine was sending me back into the crack zombie age of the 1980s that devastated not only urban America, but massive portions of the urban landscape of New York City. And the reason I was transported is I was participating in my very first cannabis parade. We lined up at 32nd and Broadway, and we were going to head south on Broadway towards Union Square Park. In my company was my girlfriend, Nancy Regula, and my oldest son, who is Anthony Sliwa. But we were joined by thousands of people, some of the burned-out hippies from the free love era of the 1960s who fit the stereotype that I had dealt with over the years in the Lower East Side when they would go into Tompkins Square Park or Washington Square Park in Greenwich Village and talk about the mantra of peace, love, and happiness while lighting up their joints. And we'd all look at them as if they were freakazoids. We would think back to the images of reefer madness that we had been weaned on. And more importantly, for my era, those baby boomers, the 1960 show Dragnet with Sergeant Joe Friday that equated the use of marijuana with dropping LSD or shooting up heroin. So we knew that was a part of history. But in the line of march were a lot of new jacks. And what I mean by new jacks is men and women you would not typically have thought would be part of a cannabis march. Yeah, you had the Rastafari with the Jiffy Pop hats talking about how they would smoke their ganj and it was a religious experience. And a lot of them looked at me and they said, oh, you're rude man, you're Yankee boy, you're blood clot. You're the very man who would take a spliff out of my mouth and have me locked up years ago. And you know something? The Rastafari were right. Because in the 80s, along with the Guardian Angels, we had a policy of zero tolerance. But now it wasn't just guys and gals coming out of the era of Woodstock and Haight-Ashbury smoking their joints, or even the Rastafari from Jamaica or other parts unknown who declared that it was part of a religious experience. I never believed that. But it was a lot of men and women who were using marijuana, some for recreational use, who by day were dressing up in their corporate attire, working on Wall Street, working retail, working in white-collar industries, and now vaping. And then there were blue-collar workers, many of them in construction, many of them who had been damaged along the way in their construction pursuits and were suffering from arthritis and rheumatism, and now were using various marijuana-laced products as a way of giving them pain relief. They would have been the first people in the 1980s, these construction workers, to take a 2x4 and hit those burned-out hippies from the 60s right in the middle of their head if they had lit up a joint in front of them. And so I most identified with them. And then there was the subway gunman, Bernard Goetz. That's right. He poured hot lead into those four black teenagers that tried to rob him on the number two train. But here he was, the libertarian, the vegan, promoting the use of marijuana for its medicinal uses. Yeah, it was an eclectic group of people. But it was a lot of people you would have never thought would have been in that line of march. And certainly, first and foremost, in the minds of many looking, was yours truly, Curtis Sliwa, Mr. Zero Tolerance. Mr., if I see you smoking a joint, I'll have you sucking concrete. And if you give me beef, I'll bust you in your teeth. Think of that. All these folks having flashbacks, thinking, gee, is Curtis Sliwa going to suddenly jump across the barricades and start making citizen arrests like I used to do in the 80s and the early 90s. But oh, have times changed. As we marched to Union Square Park, I was also in flashback mode because I recognized this was a line of march that many social activists and political types had taken over the decades. In fact, just a few days before, on May 1st, if we were in the line of march of the original May Day parade, it would have been tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands during Prohibition and the Depression, when the Socialist Workers' Party of Eugene V. Debs would get 1 million votes a year, and they would stage their rallies in Union Square Park. Or on a given day, any man or any woman could bring a soapbox box, and it didn't matter what their politics was. They could get up there and rant and rave, and the pigeons could settle on their shoulders and poop on them, and people would pass by and sometimes observe and sometimes diss and dismiss them. But it was an open assembly of different ideas, and you could joust with people. You could have forensic debate. So I was returning to the roots of a place that allowed many an American who was out of sight, out of mind, who was poor or impoverished, who didn't have the abilities that I have to be granted a microphone on the most powerful talk radio station in the nation, WABC 770, Monday through Fridays from 12 to 3, but people who could get up on a soapbox and all of a sudden spew what their belief systems were. And there was a period of time, both in Union Square Park and in Washington Square Park and in nearby Tompkins Square Park on the Lower East Side, that the beatniks came about in the 50s. And they were really the first to combine poetry with music and the open smoking and use and consumption of marijuana. And naturally, we all typified them as being freakazoids, as being from another planet, as being decadent and debaucherous and leading us on a one-way path to Palookaville. But boy, all these myths have been destroyed along the way. And as I walked into the park, I remembered where I was in the 80s, standing outside of Union Square Park, having left the L train. L at that time, not for the hipster and millennial express it has become, but L standing for lousy line. And I couldn't get in to Union Square Park from 1983 to 1985, nor could anyone else, because there had been so many dope fiends who were mainlining, who were spiking themselves, that at the time, Mayor Ed Koch decided the only way I can clean up this park of all the junkies is to put a fence around it and claim that I'm doing rehab, restoration of the park. Very similar to what happened to Yankee Stadium in the 70s, the old Yankee Stadium of roof, when the Yankees had to go play in Shea Stadium in Flushing, Queens for 2 years because they were rehabbing the old Yankee Stadium. But in this particular case, Union Square Park was not being restored because of the physicality of it, but to get the junkies and the dope fiends out. And naturally, they didn't just disappear. They went over to Tompkins Square Park on the Lower East Side, and they integrated themselves through avenues A, B, C, and D, now where the millennials and hipsters hold way. But back then, it was Dope Fiend City. How did I know? I lived right there on the cusp of Tompkins Square Park. I saw this all play out before me on Avenue A in St. Mark's Place in the tenement that I shared at that time with my wife, Lisa Sliwa, who was one of the leaders of the Guardian Angels. But oh, how times have changed. And as stunned and hard-headed as I was, as I made my way out to La La Land, Los Angeles, and organized the Guardian Angels there in the 80s, I remember we were in the west side of Los Angeles, right along the beach in Venice, and it was in the mid-1990s. And all of a sudden, storefront after storefront had opened up because they had passed a law in the state legislature in Sacramento and California allowing for medicinal use of marijuana, medical marijuana. If you could go in and see a doctor there, he or she would write you script, and you could actually make your purchase in that storefront. And I joked about it and said, oh, yeah, there are guys going in there because they have a fever in their foot, they have anxiety, they have headaches. Instead of getting a St. Joseph's baby aspirin, they're getting a joint, and they're getting high. And quite frankly, some of them did take advantage of that. But many of them who had post-traumatic stress disorder or had other serious medical and mental issues were actually using marijuana for its medicinal purposes. We didn't pay attention. And then years later, other than the storefronts along Venice Beach, it became more professional in the way this medical marijuana was sold. Along came a corporate entity called MedMen, and they started opening up establishments in California. And all of a sudden, it was like buying jewelry at Fortune Offs. Listen to what some of the initial customers had to say.
I'm very excited. It's about time. I just think it's like a legendary moment. Like, this is going to go down in history.
And then the founder of MedMen broke in and talked about how it was time.
This is the new era. Like, if you want to treat cannabis like a product and not an illicit drug, this is what it looks like.
But you see, that was in the mid-90s. And everyone thought, oh, yeah, that's because it's California. They're different. You know, they wake up in the morning, they exercise, they do their yoga, and then they smoke a joint, and they claim it's for medicinal purposes. So to me, it was out of sight, out of mind. But then all of a sudden, soon in that time period, I had been shot in the Lower East Side by the Gambino Gotti crime family and shattered with 5 hollow point bullets going through my lower extremities. I was then sent to Bellevue Hospital, where I had to recuperate back and forth for 2 separate operations in 2 years. And sweet morphine is the only thing that got me through that pain. And that's when I began to realize that, oh boy, there are some strong drugs out there, not just the heroin being shot in veins in the Lower East Side, but the morphine that was pulsating through my veins. Could there be an alternative to this? And it eventually led me to that stage in Union Square Park this past Saturday, where I announced to the hundreds who had gathered that I was there to speak about medical marijuana and how medical marijuana could bring people life and a quality of life.
That's right. I'm here to speak on behalf of those on medical marijuana because I'm one of them. Because marijuana equals life and a quality of life. For tens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people who before that suffered in silence. Let me give you a little bit of the living. Back in 1992, I was sucking concrete over on Avenue B and 6th Street, not far from here. The guys in Gambino's had pumped 5 hollow point bullets into my lower extremities. For 2 years, I was on morphine over at Bellevue. You know what a Jones morphine is to try to kick? And yet I needed it to deal with the pain. And the surgeons told me at that time, Sliwa, we put you all back together again like Humpty Dumpty who took that great fall. But years from now, you're going to have internal gastronomical issues that are going to require further surgery. And I said, come on, I'll live to be 200. I'll get a doctor like Trump got to write me up a script to say, I'm invincible. Well, in 2015, those doctors were right. I got diagnosed with colitis, took me down for the count. Then ileitis. Then in combination with that, chronic Crohn's disease. So they had me on hillbilly heroin, oxycodone, for 2 years. And after that, because that wasn't working, it was back to fentanyl, and then morphine. And then when I'm in Columbia Presbyterian and they're opening me up like a tin can over 100 stitches, they end up giving me Percocet with Tylenol. And I had a violent reaction afterwards. And then all of a sudden I said, how about medical marijuana in Columbia Presbyterian? I qualify. I got chronic Crohn's disease. And they said, we can't give you any of that. No, but you can give me morphine. You can give me fentanyl, you can give me hillbilly heroin, oxycodone, which will mean I'm an inch away from taking a dirt path with the Grim Reaper again. And they say yes. So even though we're in a state in which there is legal medical marijuana, and across the river, there was Jammu Alepe, Chris Christie, who barely allowed for medical marijuana. Let's stand together for the hundreds of thousands out there who need some relief, who need a good quality of life, who don't need to suffer as I did with projectile vomiting, with nausea, with reflux, with pain, who get chemo, who have cancer, who have thyroid issues, who have a multitude of medical issues. Let's make sure that these people have access to medical marijuana and fight. Because if not, it may come your day when you're like Curtis Sliwa and you're an inch from taking a dark path and you're going to need the help of medical marijuana because it equals life and a quality of life. Thank you.
And you hear the applause at the end for me by many of my adversaries who I had become a hemorrhoid and a red beret to during the 80s and 90s whenever they would whip out a spliff of marijuana, a joint, a bowl, a bong. It didn't matter. I viewed that drug almost equal in terms of my anger and hate for it as I did towards crack or heroin or any of the other drugs that were prevalent in that community. So for these people to applaud me, who had been a symbol of slam and jam if I caught you smoking drugs, was an amazing turnaround, never mind in terms of my own thinking. But remember, I had been on morphine in the 90s. I had it shake that Jones. It wasn't easy. Then by 2012, I had my prostate taken out, a dumb decision on my part, but it required the use of morphine in the recovery period. But then my greatest challenge came in 2015. This was 1 year after New York State had passed in its legislature in Albany the Compassionate Care Act, which allowed for the medical use of marijuana. But hey, you try to find it. It was like searching for the Fabergé eggs in Greenwich, Connecticut on Easter Sunday. They were out of sight, out of mind. And I wasn't even thinking about getting any script or prescriptions of medical marijuana, even though I was beginning to deteriorate. A year later in 2015, the surgeons who had removed the remnants of the hollow point bullets out of my lower intestines in 1992 had warned me that I would end up suffering severe gastronomical disorders later on in life. And boy, by 2015, it hit me with colitis. And then the colitis eventually developed into ileitis. And that meant my colon was damaged, my ileum was damaged. And now I was beginning to shrink. I couldn't eat. I was projectile vomiting. The combination of the two was driving me towards a dirt bath. And if that wasn't bad enough, I was hit with chronic Crohn's disease, which doubled my trouble. And now from 220 pounds and muscled, I was down to 150 pounds, and I looked like I was a survivor of a concentration camp. In fact, some people being nice said, "Oh, you look so good. You lost so much weight." And I'm saying, "What are you talking about? I'm steps away from hospice." That's right. It was that intense. So if I didn't get an operation to remedy my dilemma, which was chronic Crohn's disease, I would have been gone. And if the operation had not worked, I would have had a colostomy bag and all kinds of continued gastronomical disorders, which meant a lot of pain and a lot of strain. But all during that period of time, as I dissolved into the belly of pain, I was prescribed oxycodone, hillbilly heroin, for 2.5 years. That's how I was able to broadcast. That's how I was able to survive. But still, the pain was intense. And then after oxycodone, that strength of that drug was no longer good enough, I was issued fentanyl. And then after the operation, I was issued morphine. And then I'll never forget, just days before I was discharged from Columbia Presbyterian in December of 2017, the doctor said, "Well, before we send you home, we want to give you Percocet with Tylenol. Well, we want to test it out here because we don't want to send you home with fentanyl and morphine. It's too addictive of a drug." And I totally understood. And I took the Percocet, and I had a violent psychotic reaction. And it was at that very moment that my girlfriend, Nancy Regula, had said, "Wait a second. Do you realize Curtis qualifies for medical marijuana? He has chronic Crohn's disease. That's one of the many types of medical maladies that exist in that Compassionate Care Act that was passed back in July of 2014. Why can't you just try medical marijuana? See if that will resolve his pain issues." And the doctors in court said, "We can't do that. The federal government will not permit us to dispense out of a hospital." And I said to myself, "Wait a second, in a hospital setting, even if you take an aspirin, they register that. That's a controlled atmosphere." And no, they would not give me or allow me the use of medical marijuana. So I had to start using illegal street marijuana. And all of a sudden, I no longer had reflux. I no longer had nausea. I had an appetite again. I was able to put pounds back on my rack to the point where I was able to get up to 180 pounds and function. And that was with illegal marijuana. And then suddenly everyone kept pounding the table and saying, but you're the primetime candidate for medical marijuana. But where were you going to go? They were out of sight, out of mind. One doctor told me, oh, they don't write script in Manhattan. You got to go out to Queens. I said, on every street corner, there's somebody with a shingle that claims that they're a doctor. You mean to tell me they can't write script for medical marijuana? He said, no. And then finally I found a doctor who would actually look at my records, and clearly he said, oh, yeah, you are the perfect poster child for people who need medical marijuana. And I submitted my papers to Albany, and the Department of Health said, yep, here's your medical marijuana card. And I went to MedMen on Fifth Avenue, and what a difference it was. In fact, it was like going to a jewelry store. They had all kinds of medical marijuana products. Not the smokable type. That's not permitted in the state of New York. By Andrew Evilized Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Brutta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, who, by the way, was known as a teenager to be selling nickel and dime bads outside of a pizzeria in Holliswood, along with his friend, that's right, Ferrara. Remember him? His running mate was selling cocaine when he went up to Dartmouth. But, oh, we don't want to talk about that, do we? But there's no smokable legal medical marijuana in New York State. So you have to have it as an edible. You have to have it as a liquid in which you put it as a tincture under your tongue. You could get it in cookie form, but it gives you the relief that you desperately need without the side effects that oxycodone or morphine or fentanyl or Percocet or Vicodin have. And oh, what a relief it is for tens of hundreds of thousands of people. And yet, think of it. There are only 4 medical marijuana clinics in all of New York City with a population of 8 million plus. In the state of Arizona, there are 143 clinics in a red state in which it's mostly senior citizens. New York City is thinking of opening up 4 injection centers for dope fiends, and they only have 4 dispensaries of legal medical marijuana. How the hell does that make any sense? But thank God it exists as an alternative for so many people. And it doesn't mean that medical marijuana is the cure for all pains and people seeking relief. It may be that Vicodin is, or Percocet, or other painkillers, or fentanyl, or morphine, or in the case of those taking oxycodone, hillbilly heroin. But it ought to be part of the wardrobe of options. And that's why, in speaking as now a person who utilizes medical marijuana to survive, we've got to tell the Beauregard Jeff Sessions of the world, the attorney general, wants to take us back to the 60s, to the days of Dragnet and Sergeant Joe Friday. Keep your stinking federal hands off the medical marijuana clinics, because he not only has threatened to close down operations where recreational use of marijuana is legal in some of the states, but also where medical marijuana is available. Now, can it be improved? Of course, over time. But a doctor should be able to suggest to a patient in need, in pain, from a variety of maladies like I had, that one of your options is medical marijuana. And thank God, in this year of 2018, the lines of availability are expanding in New York, in New Jersey, where it's been legal for years, and it's now being considered to be used in states across America.